Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Teaching Tolerance to Children, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
So, as you can see, we're focusing on a number of points. And one of them is ethical versus unethical conversion, in which we have a lot of experience. Gurudeva has documented that quite nicely in How to Become a Hindu. And the other is in terms of working with youth and actually doing so in a way which is inspiring and uplifting, and not just, you know, making Hinduism a boring subject. But, for example, our Savaita Hindu religion course has some wonderful games in it that on many occasions we've been told, and that's the part that kids really like the most. You know, they come to the temple in Malaysia and come to the class, and what's the game for today? You know, that's the big interest. So areas like that where we have experience, you know, are what we're offering, and trying to do our part in helping the Malaysia Hindu Sangham re-energize Hinduism in Malaysia, taking up a large-scale task, and they seem to be going about it in a very methodical, organized way, so we want to do what we can to help. Any idea how long the talk took to read?
24 minutes.
Good. I have a 30-minute time slot, so just about the right length, counting all the introductions. Okay, have a wonderful day. Thank you very much. Good morning. This morning's talk is part of our Toronto upcoming trip in April, leaving April 9th for Toronto to be there on Yoga Swami's annual Mahasamadhi celebration day. So one of the events is primarily for the Caribbean community of Hindus up there, which is quite large, and they selected as the place for the talk the Vishnu Mandir. So the Vishnu Mandir has quite a collection of deities, and it's adding a new one. It's adding a Murugan deity. So we get to help install their Murugan deity in the Vishnu Mandir. But their goal is to be an all-community temple. That's how they describe themselves on their website. So the people from any Hindu community can come there and worship and feel at home. So first of all, we have to visualize warm weather, right? Oh, it's so sunny, and everyone's complaining how hot it is. Lots of warm, sunny weather on April 12th. So, conditions in the world today are certainly troubling. Wars between countries, wars within countries, plus a serious threat of international terrorist acts. The terrorist attacks in New York on September 11th naturally heightened everyone's concern about these problems. One of the immediate consequences of the 9/11 terrorist attacks was the presence of television coverage depicting people in a number of countries who strongly hate the United States, some to the point of wishing violence upon it. Watching these shocking reports on television, we were quite impressed by the extent and seriousness of the problem of prejudice in the world today. Attitudes of prejudice toward those who are of a different race, nation, or religion can start simply as distrust, which can then deepen into dislike, and deepen further into hatred, which can turn into a desire to inflict injury. Are we born with these attitudes? Certainly not. We are taught them at home, at school, and even in some religious institutions. In the last few months, a number of resolutions have been passed objecting to the U.S. going to war with Iraq. Others have expressed their objection by demonstrating in the streets. These actions are sincere and make a point, but they certainly do not address the core of the problem, which is hatred. People have been raised to hate those of different ethnic groups, religions, or nations. The solution, though a long-term one, is that we need in the century ahead to teach all children tolerance, openness to different ways of life, different beliefs, different customs of dress and language. We need to stop teaching them to fear those who are different from themselves. Stop teaching them hatred for peoples of other colors and other religions. Stop teaching them to see the world as a field of conflict, and instead instill in them an informed appreciation and a joyous reverence for the grand diversity we find around us. Instead of teaching children to be intolerant and to dislike and distrust, hate and inflict injury on those who are different, we can teach them to be tolerant and like and trust, befriend and help. And of course, the central place for that to occur is in the home. Secondarily, it can be further strengthened by also being taught at the temple and at school. It is in the home that we can change the world for the better. It is the qualities we cultivate in our children that create the world of the future. Therefore, the most effective form of protest to the violence in the world is to give more thought to what our children are learning as they grow up. And in this regard, every father and mother is indeed a guru. In fact, an individual's first guru. The quality we wish to develop in the child is a prejudice-free consciousness, possessing an open-mindedness that readily embraces differences in ethnic background, religion, and nationality. How can parents nurture a prejudice-free consciousness? As we mentioned previously, we are not born with prejudices. They are all learned at home, at school, elsewhere. This gives us a good overview then on how to nurture a prejudice-free consciousness, which is by carefully monitoring what children hear at home, school, and elsewhere that expresses prejudice. It is nurtured through complete avoidance of remarks which are racially or religiously prejudiced. Through discussing with our children any prejudice they hear from others at school and elsewhere, and correcting it. We can teach children to avoid generalizations about people and instead to think about specific individuals and the qualities they have. Even positive generalizations should be avoided as they encourage us not to look at the qualities of specific individuals. Television and movies can provide useful situations to discuss. It can be developed through having our children meet, interact, and learn to feel comfortable with children of other ethnicities and religions. There are a few key Hindu beliefs that are the basis for Hindu tolerance. The first belief is on the nature of God, which is the basis for Hindu tolerance of other religions. The Vishnu Mandir exemplifies that Hinduism has a wide diversity of traditions, but that the followers of the different traditions respect one another. This is based on the Hindu concept of the Supreme Being. Hinduism has four major divisions or denominations, Saivism, Saktism, Smartism, and Vaishnavism. Each calls the Supreme Being by a different name. To Saivites, the Supreme is called Shiva. Saktas refer to the Supreme as Shakti. Smartas call the Supreme Being Brahman, and to Vaishnavas, he is Vishnu. However, the important point is that each Hindu is worshipping the same Supreme Being. The name is different, the tradition is different, but it is the same Supreme Being that is being worshipped by all Hindus. There is an ancient verse from the Rig Veda that is often quoted in this regard. Ekam Sat Vipra Bahuda Vadanti. It is translated as, truth is one, sages express it variously. Reality is one, the learned speak of it in many ways, or the universal reality is the same, but different people call it by different names. This same statement from the Rig Veda can be expanded beyond Hinduism to include all the world's religions, that there is only one supreme being, and all the world's religions are in truth worshipping the same supreme being. Hindus also believe that there is no exclusive path, no one way for all. They profoundly know that the God they worship is the same supreme being in whom people of all faiths find solace, peace, and liberation. Religious beliefs are manifold and different. Hindus, understanding the strength of this diversity, wholeheartedly respect and encourage all who believe in God and do not seek to interfere with anyone's faith or practice. Since the inner intent of all religions is to bind man back to God, Hindus honor the fact that truth is one, paths are many. Ekam Sat Aneka Pantah. Nonetheless, Hindus realize that all religions are not the same. Each has its unique beliefs, practices, goals, and paths of attainment, and the doctrines of one often conflict with those of another. Even this should never be cause for religious tension or intolerance. The Hindu belief that gives rise to tolerance of differences in race and nationality is that all of mankind is good. We are all divine beings, souls created by God. Hindus do not accept the concept that some individuals are evil and others are good. Hindus believe that each individual is a soul, a divine being who is inherently good. The Upanishads tell us that each soul is emanated from God as a spark from a fire, begins its spiritual journey which eventually leads it back to God. All human beings are on this journey, whether they realize it or not. The Hindu practice of greeting another with namaskara, worshipping God within the other person, is a way this philosophical truth is practiced on a daily basis by all Hindus. This belief is taken one step further in the Vedic verse, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. The whole world is one family. Everyone is family-oriented. What we do is to benefit all the members of our family. We want them all to be happy, successful, and religiously fulfilled. And when family is defined to be the whole world, then it is clear that we wish everyone in the world to be happy, successful, and religiously fulfilled. The following Vedic verse captures this sentiment perfectly. Sarve jana sukhino bhavatu. May all people be happy. In the 20th century, Dr. Martin Luther King, after giving careful thought to the problem of discriminatory laws, selected the Hindu principle of ahimsa, as exemplified by Mahatma Gandhi's tactic of nonviolent resistance, as an effective method for overcoming the unjust laws of racial discrimination in the United States. It's interesting to note that in 1969, Dr. King spent 5 weeks in India discussing with Gandhi's followers the philosophy and techniques of nonviolence to deepen his understanding. Perhaps in the 21st century, the world can again turn to Hindu values, choosing this time the concept of tolerance as a way of creating a future for this planet that is free from war and terrorism. To be continued. Not quite finished, but has some spirit. Huh? Yeah. So the idea, it has a couple of points to it. One is it's trying, and we have to, that part has to be developed a little bit more. It's trying to show the greatness of Hinduism, you know, make Hindus proud of, gee, we've got a pretty smart religion here. It's providing values that guided the 20th century and can guide the 21st century to be a better world. You know, we don't often think of that. So that has to be developed a little bit more. Plus exactly what tolerance means. And it's one thing to say, okay, I'm tolerant, but to, and again, this has to be developed, to pin it down. So it's like children, you don't tell them just not to hate people, but you know, tolerance means to learn to trust, to like, to befriend, and to help. pin it down to that level. So it's more than just a kind of I'm tolerant of someone, but I help everyone. I like everyone. Take tolerance down to that level of action. So that needs to be developed a little bit more as well. Thank you very much for being an attentive sounding board.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be back from our journey. Nice to be back to our Sunwan Homa, get our phase off to a wonderful religious start. Our Mugiswami and I had a very successful program in Singapore and Malaysia. All the events went super well, and lots of new doors opened as well in terms of opportunities at Hindu Center in Singapore and opportunities for working with the Malaysia Hindu Sangha. So we're very happy with all of that. An interesting point was made at the Master Course seminar we had on Saturday. We had a 3-hour seminar with the teachers of the Master Course. They're, so far they've taught a few one-day seminars, and they're hoping to get a more active program whereby they teach one-day seminars followed up by weekly Master Course classes. So they were asking various questions, some of them challenging, some of them very interesting in other ways. And one of the ones that was interesting had to do with the worship of Shiva. And I could tell by the way the question was asked, I forget exactly how it was worded, that it wasn't looking at it exactly the right way. And I thought about it for a minute and answered it on the spot. And then I thought about it afterwards and came up with a little page I'll read in a minute. But somehow the person was seeing Shiva first and the Supreme Being not really seeing it. So he was worshiping Shiva, but hadn't really thought of it that he was worshiping the Supreme Being somehow. It's hard to explain it at the moment. But there was a distinction in his mind. Shiva was Shiva. So, whereas of course the idea is that all Hindus worship the Supreme Being, it's just that the different Hindu traditions and the different religions of the world had different ways of describing the Supreme Being, different names, different traditions, and so forth. But there's only one Supreme Being. It's not a question of whether Shiva is supreme over Vishnu, which was kind of the way he was looking at it, I guess, in terms of a Puranic story. We have Shiva over here, and we have Vishnu over here, and it's like two teams, two football teams or something, two soccer teams. Which one's going to win? Which one's better? It was an externalized way of looking at it. So I wrote up something in that regard, which we'll put to use somewhere. I'm not sure where. Here it is. Have you ever heard a discussion between two or more Hindus as to whether Vishnu or Shiva is the supreme god? If you encounter Hare Krishna, of course you do. Who is the more powerful of the two and therefore deserving of worship? Each of these debaters quoting different Puranic stories to support their point of view. Of course, they are missing the point, which is that all Hindus worship the supreme being. Hinduism has four major divisions or denominations, Saivism, Saktism, Smartism, and Vaishnavism, as we know. Each calls the Supreme Being by a different name, Saivites, Shiva, Saktas, Shakti, Smartas, Brahman, and Vaishnavas, Vishnu. However, the important point is that each is worshipping the same Supreme Being. The name is different, the tradition is different, but it is the same Supreme Being that is being worshipped by all Hindus. There is an ancient verse from the Rig Veda that is often quoted in this regard. Usually it's quoted in English, but try the Sanskrit here. Ekam sat vipra bahuda vadanti, which is translated, truth is one, sages express it variously, or reality is one, the learned speak of it in many ways, or the universal reality is the same, but different people call it by different names. This same statement from the Rig Veda can be expanded beyond Hinduism to include all the world religions, that there is only one supreme being, and all the world's religions are in truth worshipping the same supreme being. Therefore, if you are ever approached by someone, Mormon knocking on your door, of another religion who states that their God is superior to your God, you can refer to this ancient Rig Veda verse and state with confidence that there is only one supreme being, and you are in truth both worshiping the same supreme being, but only referring to him by different names. So, of course, we take all that for granted. But it's interesting, once you get out there in a place like Malaysia, you know, this becomes an interesting point, an important point, you know, to all of us. Of course, we know that. But out there, you do get these two problems. One is within Hinduism, not looking at it correctly, and the other is the influence or the challenge of other religions. When Hindus are approached by missionaries of other religions, what do they say when someone says, why do you worship so many gods? How can you have 330 million gods? So forth. So this is a way of answering that with confidence. We had a nice presentation at the Ganesha Temple in Penang, Shakti Vinayagar Temple. And some 600 people or so were there, a very big turnout. Each of them came up for Vibhuti afterwards, which Warma Goswami said it was 10 an hour, and therefore, I mean 10 a minute, and took an hour, therefore there were 600. It seemed about right. Anyway, it was a talk, prepared talk, which was translated ahead of time. My friend Lord Ganesha, of course, you've heard the talk. And the challenge was for Ahila, you all know Ahila, was the translator. So she had to sit there and read the translation, which was a first for her. She did very, very well. And fortunately, she didn't try and translate a few of my spontaneous remarks, which would be more challenging. I was hoping to get a few examples in the talk and real-life examples. One came in late, came in during the trip, so I thought I'd read it anyway this morning. It's such a nice story. It's from Kamala Valen. We all know Kamala. This was a number of years ago when she was going to university. So she says, while I was going to university, it was a general practice of mine to vow to Lord Ganesha to complete a certain religious task for a specific duration of time and ask for blessings and help with exams and schoolwork. For example, I would often vow to attend puja at the temple every day for a week straight and pray for the deva's help to do well on my exams. During the last year of my degree, I was facing a very important interview for entrance into an internship program. Without acceptance into an internship program, I could not receive the professional designation of registered dietitian and would not have achieved the goal of 4 years of university studying. The process was highly competitive, and as it turned out, only 1 in 8 students in my class were admitted into the internship program. As the interview drew near, I went to the temple and sat and prayed to Lord Ganesha. I told him that I would make coming to see him daily a priority in my life for a minimum 2 weeks and as long as I could after that, and prayed for him to remove any obstacles blocking my path from having a successful interview and being accepted into the internship program. The next day the routine began. I woke up early in the morning and went to the temple for the early morning puja. Only after my attendance at the puja would the rest of my day begin. This routine continued and the day of the interview drew near. On the day of the interview, I was getting ready and reviewing some possible interview questions my family and I had prepared. I remember that I was brushing my teeth when three different interview questions just entered my mind. It wasn't like the questions had popped up into my mind or that they came up suddenly like a bolt of lightning. It was more like they were there, just like I knew what my name was. The interview questions were somewhat unusual and a little complicated to answer, so I mentally prepared answers to them as I drove to the interview. As it turned out, I was asked all three questions during the interview. They were asked in exactly the same way they came to me. Thanks to the Devas, I had already prepared my answers and was easily able to handle three tough interview questions and finish the interview successfully. That night, I went to the temple and thanked Lord Ganesha and the Devas for helping me. A few months later, I was accepted into the internship program. Isn't that a great story? I mean, it's just so real. I remember she made reference to it many years ago and never told the whole story. And so I asked her for it. And she sent it and said, "You can use my name." She wasn't shy about it. But it's a wonderful story in that it shows how practical our religion can be, and that it should be practical. The worship of Lord Ganesha should help us do better on a test. It should be that practical to us. It should help us get a better job. It shouldn't be something etheric, untangible, intangible. It should be pragmatic, something we can see in our life in a very definite way, how the worship of Lord Ganesha helps us. So that was the general theme without this example, but the general theme of the talk at the Ganesha temple there. And my friend Lord Ganesha, as you know, is designed as a theme for children's class, a catchy title for one of the topics in a series of classes for children. So we're hoping that the teachers there, which are the Donabalan family, and also in Singapore and Klang, will use this topic as one of their themes for teaching children. One more prepared response to the trip. Again, I don't know exactly where we'll use it, but a lot of lecturing on Hinduism. You know, we attended this Hindu Renaissance event, and I gave a talk, and Swami from Africa gave a talk, Swami Ganananda, and Swami Vijayananda from India gave a talk. Shivacharya Muthukumaras Gurukal gave a talk, and Dr. Jagadishan gave a talk as well. So five long talks on Hinduism. And as I was thinking about it all, I said, boy, we sure can make Hinduism complicated, you know. And one of the beauties of Gurudeva's approach to Hinduism is that Gurudeva can make it so simple, so pragmatic. So I was thinking this morning along that line. So this is in that spirit. Have you ever tried to explain to another what the purpose of our Hindu practices was? Perhaps as a parent, your child asked you, why are Hindus vegetarian? Or what is the purpose of going to the temple? Or why do we meditate? Of course, we can opt for a philosophical answer, such as to resolve our karma, realize God, and be liberated from reincarnation. This, of course, is a technically perfect answer. However, it is so abstract, it doesn't give the child a clue as to how in Hinduism we are expected to behave. Therefore, a simpler answer would be a more useful one. Here is a simple answer that focuses on behavior. Hinduism teaches us how to become a better person, improve our behavior, live as spiritual beings on this earth. Three ways of saying the same thing. Man's nature can be described as threefold: spiritual, intellectual, and instinctive. It is the instinctive nature, the animal-like nature, which contains the tendencies to become angry and harm others. The goal is to learn to control these animal instincts as well as the ramifications of the intellect and manifest one's spiritual nature. This is nicely stated in Tirukkural, verse 35. Virtue is living in such a way that one does not fall into these four: envy, anger, greed, and unsavory speech. In fact, learning to control anger is such an important part of improving our behavior that the Thirukkural devotes an entire chapter to this subject. The chapter points out through its 10 verses that anger gives rise to teeming troubles, kills the face's smile and the heart's joy. When it's uncontrolled, will annihilate you, burns even friends and family who try to help, and easily leads to injuring others.